Welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we will take you to Freeport for a talk by Michael Bruhn, the executive director of the Sierra Club. Bruhn is also the author of Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. He has also formerly worked for Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network. He was a recent guest at the annual meeting of the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Jim Frick, the executive director of the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club.
Now for what you've been waiting for. Growing up on the New Jersey shore, Michael Bruhn first encountered pollution when, as a young surfer, he developed a body rash from the dangerous waste washing up on the beach. He got involved with community groups who successfully stopped the pollution, and he learned an early lesson in how effective grassroots organizing can be. Like many Sierra Club folks, Michael developed an early love of and appreciation for nature through regular family camping trips to state and national parks. During one of those trips to the great state of Maine, Michael actually took his first steps and learned to walk at a state park in Maine. In high school, Michael had a knack for math. In fact, his affinity for numbers earned him the nickname The Count. Not surprisingly, he went on to earn dual BA degrees in economics and finance from Westchester University. But following graduation, a trip to America's national parks and wildlands changed Michael's focus. He decided to go to work as an organizer for Greenpeace. He soon learned that he had found his calling. In 1998, he joined the Rainforest Action Network and later served 7 years as that group's executive director. With the network, Michael led a highly publicized and very successful campaign targeting Home Depot, which ultimately helped protect more than 5 million acres of British Columbian rainforest. Now, I know I've read this. I'm not sure it's absolutely true. Michael can tell us when he gets up here. But during one of the protests at an Atlanta Home Depot, Michael is said to have commandeered the store's PA system and loudly announced, "Attention, shoppers, in aisle 13, you will find wood from the heart of the rainforest." Time magazine recognized the Home Depot victory as the most important environmental story of 1999. Michael took over the executive director position at the Sierra Club in March 2010, when the club was deeply immersed in climate change work. The new position was a perfect fit for him, because he had just recently published his book, Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. This highly acclaimed book addresses global warming issues and lays out an ambitious plan for moving America to a clean energy economy that will create good jobs and a healthier planet. Please give our heartfelt welcome to our National Sierra Club leader, Michael Bruhn.
Thank you, Jim, for that mostly true introduction. I'm gonna step over here a little bit. No. This is good. Yeah. So, what I would like to do today is talk a little bit about the Sierra Club nationally and what we're doing and how it hopefully will support all the great work that you're doing locally. I can introduce myself a little bit more, but before I do, I wanted to just do two quick things, one of which is to say that silent auctions really do help a great deal. So if you've looked at some of those items or if you've thought about looking for those items, I won't feel offended if at some time over the next 3 hours while I'm talking here tonight, if you want to take a stroll back there, all of the money goes to the local main chapter, all of it stays here in the state. All of it supports the important work that we're doing here, and all of it is needed. So feel free to go browse. Feel free to add a zero to whatever your total is on the left side of the decimal, preferably. Thanks to everybody who's already supported. But then the other thing that I would like to do, actually, before I talk, is to learn a little bit from all of you. So can you raise your hand if you've just joined the Sierra Club as a member, or just got involved in the last, say, 5 years? All right. Excellent. How about if you've been a member of the Sierra Club volunteering for 10 years or more? Please raise your hand. Excellent. Anybody here who's been volunteering for 20 years or more? Yes. All right. Excellent. Thank you. 25? Okay. Let me go in the other direction. Is there anybody for whom this is your first Sierra Club dinner or event or activity overall? Yes. Raise your hands. All right. How are we treating you so far? Good? You need anything? Can we get you some water? Well, welcome. Maybe one other question. So I'm curious about how you all feel about how we're doing in our job of saving the planet.
You mean Sierra Club or collectively as a species?
All of us, yeah. As a species. Well, let's make it more specific. So raise your hand. This is a two-part question. You can raise your hand hopefully just once. So raise your hand. We'll talk about climate change. Raise your hand if you think that 20 years from now we have stopped the increase of greenhouse gas emissions. We've started to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, started to reduce the concentrations of GHGs in the atmosphere, and we will have a clear pathway by which we can avoid the worst consequences of climate change. I'm going to ask folks to raise their hand first if you think that that's true, and then second if you think that's not true. And I know some of you want to just change the question just a little bit, or you want to have a third option. So I know that there's that temptation. But if you think. So there's no right or wrong. So for those of you who most days think that 20 years from now, we'll be in a better place, we'll have gone over the hump, please raise your hand. Okay. And those who think that 20 years from now, we're going to try real hard, but we're going to be in a much worse place. Well, I would say if someone had asked me that question, I probably would have cheated. And what I probably would have done is tried to raise my hand both times. And I think that many of us, when you read the news every day or you watch the news, it's hard not to feel grim sometimes when you're thinking about climate change. I don't know if folks saw the news this morning about how the increase in greenhouse gas emissions is the largest increase ever, largest increase we've ever seen in 1 year, and it was substantially worse than the worst-case scenario put before by the IPCC just a couple of years ago. And so when you read that and you also see, as Paul was saying, the direction that we're going in the discourse in this country and the failure to have major transformative change at the federal scale, when you stack all of those things up, it's hard to feel optimistic. But then the things that give me a lot of optimism are part of what I believe it's Andy was saying earlier about activists of all ages who are getting more involved and who are plugging into very specific, mostly local fights and winning often. And I want to talk about that in a few minutes. But they're growing in numbers. That gives me a lot of hope. And we're building up a significant roster of important victories. And then the other thing is that we are starting to see some significant penetration of clean energy. Portugal went from 17% to 45% clean energy in 5 years. Germany is now at 33% clean energy. In Iowa, we have 20% wind. So in just the last few years, we've made significant progress in a very difficult international environment and then here domestically. So So I just want to say it's fascinating for me to be here because I just came in today, and tomorrow I'm heading down to Washington. And when I came in the room, I said hi to Becky, talked with Karen a little bit, and then I ran into this guy who I'd never met before, your state representative, or one of the state representatives, John Hink. So John is, unbeknownst to me until about 20 minutes ago, a very special person in my life because one of the things that Jim said in his introduction that was true was that I did grow up in New Jersey. I did grow up on the Jersey Shore. And when I was about 14 or 15 years old, the water in New Jersey was horrible, extremely polluted from a couple different sources, one of which was hospital waste was allowed to be dumped off the coast of New Jersey, raw hospital waste, which would wash up on shore. You may have heard about hypodermic needles washing up on shore in New Jersey in the 80s. And then also we had a chemical factory in the town near where I grew up, a town called Toms River, New Jersey. And this chemical factory was owned and operated by a company that was part of a national or international corporation called, at the time, Ciba Geigy. And this company was the only factory in New Jersey, of which there are many, that was allowed to dump raw, untreated chemical wastes straight into the ocean. No filter, nothing cleaning up, no pollution controls. All the waste could just be dumped right into the ocean, about 3 miles from where I lived. And so when you would go in the water, particularly after they expanded the plant, you'd come out with rashes. The beaches were closed for days on end, weeks on end. For a few summers, most of the entire summer, the beaches were closed. And my father, who was for a time the mayor of the town that I grew up in, but also was a builder, I saw how it had a significant impact on the local economy and on our family. And just I saw how not only could I not go in the water and my friends couldn't go in the water all summer long, but the entire economy crumbled. And John Hink was working for one of those groups, those community groups, who came in and started knocking on doors. So John Hink ran the campaign and in Lavalette, New Jersey. And he was the person who, when I went down to the beach one day and there was this big rally on the beach and people were holding hands for miles on end, it was one of my first examples of grassroots environmental advocacy. John Hink was the guy who spoke that night or that day. And this campaign ultimately won. And so I had a really great example growing up of how local grassroots advocacy, the same stuff that we're doing here in Maine with Green Sneakers, going from one house to the next house to the next house to the next house, talking about environmental problems, the fact that we have real solutions, and organizing people to get involved in practical solutions to common problems, how it works. So now, me and my wife and our two kids, we visit my parents' same house every summer. Jim came to visit, which is where he got some of that really personal information in the introduction. And you go swimming in the ocean in New Jersey, and you see dolphins every summer. And I could see my feet when I walk in the beach, which you couldn't do years ago. So for me, there are a lot of reasons for optimism when you think of our ability to achieve great things when we work together collectively. After going to school, I began working for Greenpeace for a few years, and then my first job as an organizer and as a campaigner was, as Jim said, to convince Home Depot. So I'll tell you that story a little bit because I think part of our job, whether we're whatever role we play in the environmental movement, part of our job is to organize, to tell our friends, to tell our neighbors, to tell the people with whom we go to church or at the office to help out, even if it's something as simple as recycling and sending in a check to your favorite environmental group, or if it's getting on a bus and actually doing a whole series of things that would take more time and more energy. So one of the things we all need to do is to organize in whatever way is comfortable for us. And the other thing that I think is important for us to do is to find unusual partners. And so the story I want to tell you is about Home Depot. So after canvassing for Greenpeace for a few years and working out in San Francisco, Philadelphia, then San Francisco for Greenpeace. I got hired by Rainforest Action Network to, my job was to try to convince Home Depot or to convince Kinko's, who at the time was the largest seller of paper in the country, and Home Depot, both to stop using any wood or any paper coming from old growth forests. With Kinko's, it took one letter. Largest buyer of paper in North America at the time, who was buying paper from old growth forests all across the world and had no real environmental policy dictating where the paper should come from, how much recycled content should be in that paper, whether there should be tree-free alternatives. We wrote one letter. It was maybe a page and a half, and said there's a crisis in the world's forests, here in the United States and around the world. You're the largest consumer of paper. You have both an obligation but also an opportunity to effect great change, and will you join us? Will you work with us? And they wrote back about 3 or 4 weeks later and said, you're right. We need to do more. We really do buy a lot of paper. And that does cause a lot of deforestation. That is damaging to intact ecosystems, the people who live in these in forests, people who depend on forests, and the species who call these forests their homes. So we can do more, and we will do more. So we promise to not source any paper coming from old growth forests, and we'll track every ream of paper from the shelf back to the stump. And we will increase the amount of recycled content, and we're going to make this a priority for our company. And to this day, they've followed through on that commitment, and they've done an excellent job. Home Depot took a lot more motivation, right? So they went through a process of not accepting that this was a real issue, not accepting that they had a responsibility. We had conversations with them for years about, they would argue, they would advance the arguments that they would hear from their suppliers, logging companies, that clear-cutting ancient forests actually helps to make those forests healthier. There was one argument that went around for a couple years about how clear-cutting in ancient forests in British Columbia is actually really good for bears because it creates temporary meadows where those bears can get more sun. This is a legitimate argument. This was a serious argument. So we did everything that we could to try to convince Home Depot to change. We did protests out in front of their stores. Rainforest Action Network, we were as creative as we could be. So we took out ads in the Atlanta Journal and Constitution because Home Depot is based in Atlanta. We had a picture of their CEO and president at the time, our chairman, saying how two guys in pinstripe suits cut down more forest than anyone in flannel shirts. Home Depot was building this giant new headquarters tower, and someone sent us the plans for it, and we found out that there was an abandoned pipe underneath the headquarters building, and so we had a team of climbers go into this pipe at 2 o'clock in the morning, climb up this giant tower, wait till the sun rose, went out on the arm of the tower 200 feet above the ground, and then hung a giant banner saying, Home Depot, please stop selling old growth wood. CNN was there and got major coverage. So we did all these protests, and then what began to happen is that we would get calls from all across the country, from Home Depot employees, people who would say, you know what, I work at this company. It's an awesome company to work for. They've got a great employee stock ownership program. I've got flexible hours. I can work early in the morning. I can be home for my kids. I want to stay working here. And I don't want to work for a company that's destroying the planet that my kids are going to grow up and inherit someday. So we want to help you. They would call and they'd say, I want to help you however I can. And so we would get advice about what wood Home Depot was buying, where it was coming from. They would tell us how the company was responding to all of our protests. So then I started to talk to this one person inside the company who began to consult with us about how we could make our campaign more effective. And he would tell us how to make our protests more impactful. And so he called up one day and he says, I have these intercom codes. And we were thinking that, you know, it's good to be out in front of a Home Depot on a Saturday afternoon and there's 40 or 50 people and you're passing out pamphlets. That's pretty good. But what if you did that inside the store? I can give you the intercom codes, he said, and you can just come inside and talk to our customers directly. So it's pound 80. If you want to, you know, if you get lost or something. So it was pound 80. So you'd go in, you'd press pound 80, and then you'd be on the intercom. So after getting the codes, I went one day. I had a meeting with Home Depot later that afternoon. I went down to Atlanta, and if you go to their headquarters across the highway, the freeway there, there's a Home Depot store that's open to the public, but it's also a training store for all of their regional, you know, sales managers and store managers. And so they bring people in there who, you know, they've got really nice shoes and they're wearing suits, shirts and ties, but they're actually Home Depot associates for the day. So I thought that would be a great place to test this message out. And so I went up and, you know, pressed pound 80 and I grabbed the intercom. And as Jim said, I, you know, said, attention shoppers. And I said, talked about the mahogany that they're selling that's coming straight from the Amazon rainforests. And then there was a 30-second delay, so I put down the intercom. I just stood there. I waited, and I was standing near a bunch of Home Depot employees. So when they heard this, the one guy said, find out who that is and get him. So I thought, all right, well, that works. So I went to another aisle, and I made another message. And so I said, you know, attention shoppers, you should also know that we're selling Luan plywood here. And this Luan comes from tropical rainforest in Indonesia. And in Indonesia, and this is true, in Indonesia, all of the remaining old growth, intact rainforests, Sumatran tiger habitat, sun bears, some of the most beautiful rainforests on the planet, are most of it will be gone in the next 20 years, unless this stops. So then I left a third message talking about old growth redwoods coming from Northern California. And finally, after the third message, I wanted them to know who was leaving the message, so I just sat there with the intercom in my hand. And then eventually, so I saw that this one person walk past the aisle, and he saw me, and he turned down the aisle, and then he started running towards me full speed. I thought he was going to take me out right up against the, you know, the skill saws and table saws. So, you know, I was just bending my knees. And so he stopped right in front of me and said, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing? And then the next thing he says is, why don't you get a job? So I said, well, actually, this is my job, which totally blew his mind. So he says, you know, I'm going to call the police. And at that point, he was angry, and the police were my friends at that point. So I said, you should call the police. Let's go outside. So he called the police, and he escorted me outside. So we're walking outside, and by now there's a crowd of Home Depot employees following us outside. And he came outside, and he said again, like, I just don't understand why you have to pull these stunts. And I said, neither do I. Neither do I. Look what I have to do to convince you to do something that you should be doing anyway. And, you know, so he said, why don't you just write us a letter? I did it 5 years ago. In fact, we've gotten our members to send tens of thousands of letters. He says, why don't you have a meeting with your company? I said, I'm doing my fifth meeting with your company in about 2 hours. And so he went through all of the things that we should do to get the company's attention. And I said, you're right. You know, I shouldn't have to do this. We shouldn't even have to do these campaigns for something that we all really care about. Most of us really care about protecting healthy forests. We want clean air. We want clean water. We want wilderness areas. We're all in this together. But look at the things we have to do just to convince your company and your leaders to pay attention to an issue. So finally, the police officers came, and he decided not to press charges, and they left. And then he walked me over to my car, and there was still a crowd of folks. They were about, you know, maybe from me to the where the bar is away, and he didn't want his lips to be red, but he said, "Well, look, really support what you're doing." And if there's anything I could do to help, just let me know. So 3 months later, Home Depot said that they would not sell any wood from any old growth forests anywhere on the planet. Time magazine did call it the biggest environmental victory of what was then 1999. And it did help us. It stopped clear-cutting that day in intact rainforest in British Columbia, and it helped us to protect 5 million acres. So, I tell that story just because that is where I come from, and I think all of you are here today because you've been a part of similar victories, perhaps, here in Maine or in your lifetime, or you at least have a belief and a hope that when we work together and when we set a really ambitious goal and we are diligent and we pace ourselves sometimes over a really long time, we actually can achieve really fantastic things. So I've been at the Sierra Club now for about a year and a half. And the way I came to the Sierra Club was very much like how Jim said, in that I was at Rainforest Action Network for about 12 years, 7 years as ED. And in one of my last years, I was talking to Rolling Stone magazine. They're doing a story on some of the top environmental leaders in the country. And they wanted to know what was the best thing that had been done in the environmental movement over the last 25 years. And I didn't hesitate. I said it's the work that the Sierra Club has been doing on stopping the construction of new coal-fired power plants. Hands down. Best thing that any group has ever done. And so what you should know about that is that if you're a paid staff person working for one organization, and if you have Rolling Stone magazine call you up and say, what's the best thing that's ever been done, and you talk about what another organization has done, it raises eyebrows. So the real secret is I got fired from RAN. No, I'm just kidding. But I say that just because it is true. And do folks here know the full story of the Sierra Club campaign on coal and how it all got started? Because it's great. It's really good. So the way this worked is back in 2001, you might remember there was this secret energy task force that Dick Cheney put together, and he was chairing it. And there were dozens of meetings between the Bush White House, Bush administration officials, and a whole series of energy executives. And one of the clearest and probably most high-profile proposals that came out of that was a proposal to build 150 new coal-fired power plants all across the country. Large power plants. These would have basically replaced a whole series of old and outdated power plants with massive facilities in every region across the country. And then in the few years after that, there were a whole bunch of utilities, particularly in the Midwest and down in Texas, a little bit in the West, and certainly here in the Northeast, that added several dozen more new proposals for new coal power plants, again, all across the country. So at one point, there was about 200, maybe 205, 210 new plants that would have been built on top of what we have today, which is about 500, 525 or so existing power plants. So the Sierra Club, what it would have done would have locked in coal as the dominant source of power in this country for the next half century, next 50 years. It would have guaranteed that coal would be the primary way that we get power, more than any other energy source for the next half century, which is a big problem if you care about climate change, and it's a big problem if you care about public health. Coal is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. It's the fastest growing source of greenhouse gas emissions in the country. Coal is the largest source of mercury poisoning, which is a potent, debilitating brain poison, causes reproductive disorders, developmental disorders. Just the soot, the particulate matter that comes from coal alone kills 13,000 Americans every year, prematurely. Every year, 13,000 people die because of the soot coming from coal. Mining coal has leveled more than 500 mountains throughout Appalachia in a process called mountaintop removal. It's buried more than 2,000 miles of streams. So this is a big problem, building a whole new fleet of coal plants. And so the Sierra Club, our response to that, this is now 2002, was to start by focusing on two plants. It was mostly almost exclusively volunteer-driven. We had one paid staff person working up in Madison, Wisconsin, and we took on one plant just south of Chicago, and then another plant in the heart of coal country in Kentucky. And even the paid staff person that we hired wasn't an energy expert. The volunteers who were working on this were everyday folks like you and me. They had day jobs, they had families, they had busy lives, but they taught themselves how to read energy permits and permits for air pollution controls or the lack thereof. But they taught themselves about all of the things that would be required to actually build a coal plant in their neighborhood, and they began to organize. They began to do the same things that John Hink did in New Jersey and that we all do when we're advocating for anything. They called up their friends, they called up their neighbors, they called up Sierra Club members in the neighborhood, and they educated themselves about the issue, and they found ways to get involved. And we won. We stopped the Endek coal plant just south of Chicago, about 50 miles south of Chicago. And then we began to organize throughout the region. So we went from, and we won down in Kentucky. So we went from focusing on two plants to about two dozen. And we won almost all of those at the same time, plant after plant after plant. We took the folks who won in the first couple campaigns, and they began doing regional organizing, going from town to town to town, saying, here's what worked. Here's what the impact will be from this coal plant in your neighborhood. Here's how your health will suffer. Here's alternatives that show that we can continue to keep the lights on, we can continue to keep the economy humming, but if we invest in energy efficiency and if we invest in clean energy, we'll cut our energy costs, we'll put more people to work, we'll improve public health, and we'll help to stabilize our climate. And so out of those couple dozen plants, we won almost every one again. So then we began to build a coalition of national allies across the country. Hundreds of local community groups, national organizations like Earth Justice, Rainforest Action Network got involved, Greenpeace got involved, NRDC, literally hundreds of organizations, big ones, small ones, ones with huge budgets, ones with literally no budgets, people in their communities who just didn't want to be breathing dirtier air. And we began to defeat coal plant after coal plant after coal plant after coal plant. So much so that today, now, we've defeated 153 of those proposed coal plants all across the country, 153 of them. So as great as that work is, and I can say easily that I think this is the best work that's been done in the environmental movement, in large part because I was a very small part of it, even at Rainforest Action Network. As good as that work is, all that did was stop the rate at which emissions would have grown. The victory is huge. What we prevented is basically a 15% increase in greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. If those plants had been built, it would have caused our greenhouse gas emissions to increase by 15%. As it is, it's been capped. Our U.S. greenhouse gas emissions is the same now. It's actually a little bit less now than it was back in 2006. So there's progress there. So the bigger thing that it does is it gives us the chance now to focus on the second phase of this work, which is to identify the oldest plants in the country, the biggest coal plants in the country, the dirtiest coal plants in the country, to retire them, make sure that they're shut down, and then replaced with clean energy. And so that's exactly what we're doing. We have a goal that we fully intend to reach to retire a third of the plants in the United States, to lock in the retirement of a third of the plants in the United States in the next 4 years. By the end of 2015, we will have one-third of the U.S. coal plants on a legally enforceable schedule to be retired. Many of them will have already been retired by the end of 2015, but all of those plants will be retired by the end of 2020. So we want to lock that in the next 4 years, and we're going to do it. And then the challenge, so that there's two parts to it. One part is to make sure that the coal plants go offline, and then the second part is to make sure that we're replacing all of that dirty energy with genuinely clean energy. And so this is our big challenge as individuals and as an organization and as a movement, because we don't do that so well, right? As good-hearted as we are and as kind as we are as individuals, as visionary as we can sometimes be as a movement, our track record of fighting for things is pretty thin. Our track record of stopping bad things is pretty good. We know that we're really good at stopping coal plants. If you want to stop a timber sale and stop clear cutting in the North Woods or the Pacific Northwest or anywhere across the country, we know how to do that really well. But advocating for the things we want and not just the things that we fear, that's our growth area as an organization. And this is what we're going to be putting a big emphasis on over the next few years, is both parts of that. We want to continue to focus on making sure old plants are coming offline, stopping dirty pipelines, stopping bad timber sales, stopping destructive mining projects up in Alaska or elsewhere, but then also focusing on the alternatives that we want to see. And so it's really exciting for me to come here today just to because of the connection with John Hank, but also to hear about the Green Sneakers program, to hear about the work that you're doing on energy efficiency throughout the state, to hear about the potential for offshore wind here in Maine, which could be an example for what's being done in other parts of the country. Because getting really good at our advocacy for solutions is something that is mission critical for our organization and our movement. We have an enormous ability to make sure that all of this dirty energy is taken offline, and it's taken offline forever. And we have an opportunity to make sure that we're not replacing coal with more nuclear power, or that we're not replacing coal with natural gas or large quantities of natural gas that's coming from fracked wells in Pennsylvania or West Virginia or Colorado or Texas or Wyoming. But we have an opportunity to make sure that when we take dirty energy offline, the first way that demand is met is through reduced demand. The next way that demand is met is through utilizing every single solar opportunity that we have and wind opportunity, and only then and geothermal where it's appropriate, but only then focusing on having a tiny portion of that, a small portion of that, as small a portion as possible coming from natural gas. But maximizing our ability to advocate for real solutions is the way that we can make sure that we're not replacing one set of problems with another set of problems that'll take us another couple decades to solve. So I wanted to talk about that part of the coal campaign, because it's a very local campaign, but it also has the national element of the strategy is important, making sure that the EPA is properly defended. So thank you for holding happy hours where we say thank you to Lisa Jackson and the EPA for existing. But then also, you know, making sure that the clean energy comes online is a big priority of ours. I just want to say a couple other things and talk a little bit about this Keystone XL pipeline issue. How many folks here are getting on a bus tomorrow to head down to Washington? All right. Excellent. Good. Thank you. So this is, for me anyway, this is I cannot identify a more current and clear example of the power of organizing and grassroots action, because the Sierra Club, Natural Resources Defense Council, Rainforest Action Network, Earth Justice, Earthworks, there's been about a dozen groups that have been working to stop expansion in the tar sands for several years now. And we've been working to heighten the profile of the Keystone XL pipeline and make sure that it's not built whatsoever. It was only about 6 or 8 months ago that we began to identify President Obama and put the heat on the president and push him to make a strong decision. And it was only when we did that that this issue became so high profile. And it was only through determined and fair but strong activism that we were able to make sure that the president embraced this as his decision and took on the responsibility to decide whether or not this pipeline should be built. And I think it's important to highlight the fact that this was not a high-profile issue 6 or 8 months ago. It wasn't on the news every day. We weren't getting stories in newspapers, major newspapers. Literally on a every other day, there's a big story coming out about Keystone XL. The only reason this was done was because we identified the president as a top issue. It was because of the great work that was done by Bill McKibben and others out in front of the White House in August. The work that's been done throughout the fall, going to the president's campaign offices and saying to the president, you know, we'll work for you when you work for us, as many folks have done. And then currently to organize for this event that's happening on Sunday. The good news, well, the bad news is that we've got a long way to go. The president is not yet inclined to reject the pipeline. The good news is that we've put them in an impossible position because he now has to either stand with his base and stand up to polluters or disappoint the people who put him in office in order to continue with a process that's nearly at the end. But I wanted to bring this up because just to let you know that this is for us the current flashpoint of what is our second big national campaign that will get larger and more impactful over time. And it's also one that is important here in Maine, which is we have to move, just as we have to move beyond coal, we have to move beyond oil. And so we've brought in one of my oldest colleagues who worked with me in British Columbia to help protect forests there, who worked with us to convince Home Depot, Michael Marks, who's now running the Beyond Oil campaign for us, along with Daryl Clark, the volunteer out of Los Angeles. But what we're doing is, over the next year, what you'll see from us is we will be connecting all of these extreme energy sources and these extreme disasters. So whether it's an oil spill on the Yellowstone River that we saw this summer in Montana, or last summer's oil spill in the Kalamazoo in Michigan, or the oil disaster that happened in the Gulf, or the oil problems that we saw and continue to see up in the Arctic, and this Keystone Pipeline, we'll be tying this all together as examples of an interconnected problem. But then at the same time, we'll be putting significant energy into advancing the solutions and what can we realistically, pragmatically, but still aggressively do to reduce our dependence on oil over the next 20 years? How far do we think we can go and still keep the buses running, still make sure that we can get from place A to place B, and employing Sierra Club members to advocate for specific solutions. It's one of the things that I'm most excited about because I think that there's a leadership vacuum in this country around oil, and it's the role for the Sierra Club, I think, to put together a big coalition of folks from across the political spectrum who know that it's beyond time for us to get off oil and we have solutions that are available today that can be embraced. I guess the final thing that I want to talk about is the work that you all have done here in Maine to identify the Maine woods as one of the top five conservation priorities in the country from the Department of the Interior is fantastic. And part of what we want to be doing as much as we can is to integrate the two biggest pieces of the Sierra Club historically, which is our outdoors program, our outings programs, which takes tens of thousands of people into nature every month, with our conservation work, where we've protected more than 125 million acres over the last 120 years, and to do what we can to integrate those two programs so that we are training and recruiting and supporting a new generation of volunteers who can advocate for and inspire others to advocate for a greater system of interconnected areas. So we hope to find a way to put more resources into the fight to make sure that we're having a better system of interconnected protected areas here in Maine, working with Karen and others. But what we want to do is to make this a model for the rest of the country about using our outings program to really engage people in their local fights in their backyards for the places that they love. I do want to say that it's a Friday night, and I know that you all made a choice to come here, just like you make a choice to get involved, whether you're volunteering or doing a phone bank or showing up and tabling at an event or writing a check. It's also Friday night, and for me, it's the end of a really long week. I've got two little kids at home, and it was great to hear the awards tonight. It's really inspiring. One of the perks that I have in my job is that I do get to visit a lot of chapters. I've spent some time with the chapter in Iowa and in Virginia and down in New Mexico and up in Washington and Georgia and Florida a couple weeks ago. And I don't know if you all have an idea of how much the Sierra Club is getting done. But it's really inspiring when you get a sense of the fact that we have tens of thousands of volunteers all across the country working on very specific and very important local campaigns. And it adds up to something that's just immensely inspiring and really beautiful. So just getting back to that original question of, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic? Paul and I were talking a little while ago about the fact that we live in a time where we have solutions on climate change and to most of our problems that are right there, that are available. They're practical, they're pragmatic, they're market tested, they're ready. And we need to create the political contexts and political space for them to be utilized. And it reminds me of this quote that Gandhi used to say, where he said that the gap between what we're doing and what we're capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems. So thank you all for working to close the gap. So I think we have time for one or two questions or comments. Wisecracks? Yes.
I recently just moved to New Hampshire.
You have a mic coming to you.
I recently just moved to New Hampshire where they do have a coal plant, and I think there is a Sierra Club effort to shut the Seabrook coal fire plant down. Sorry, in Newington. It's actually in Newington. The Seabrook is the nuclear. Sorry. Merrimack Station? Thank you. This is why I'm asking all this, because I don't know anything about it. And at the same time, there is a proposal to build a new transmission system from the Quebec Hydro-Quebec. And I'm wondering if our effort to shut the coal plant down in New Hampshire, what are we hoping to replace that with, and is Hydro-Quebec part of the equation?
I don't have enough info to give you a definitive answer on that. What I can say is that, well, I really can't say much, to be honest with you. I do know that we're working to shut the plant down. I do know at the same time we're working to promote more distributed generation in New Hampshire and throughout the region. So I was saying before about our loading order of the energy sources that we prefer, it would be efficiency and then solar and wind and then geothermal before any kind of role for gas or certainly for large hydro. But I don't know about that specific plant, what the timeline is for it to be, when we want, the lag between when it's announced to be shut down and then when it could, and then what we would want to fill in the mix. And for me, the timeline is actually really important because in some places, like we just retired the plant right across the Potomac River in Virginia. And in that one, we found that it was producing electricity that wasn't needed, or it was producing electricity that was easily replaced. So that's a coal plant that will be shut down by October of next year. And you compare that to the state of Washington, there's a coal plant there, the only coal plant. It's a massive facility. It produces 10% of greenhouse gas emissions in the whole state. And there's two different units in that plant. One won't be shut down until 2020. The other one won't be shut down until 2025. and it's taking so long because they want to give time for efficiency investments to take hold, but then also they're scaling up wind in a very aggressive way there. So and then as well as some gas to fill in. So sometimes a longer timeline allows for bigger development of clean energy. So the short answer is that I don't know specifically what the mix would be there. But I can, if you give me your card, I can get you more info. One more question, yes.
You talk about shutting down the coal plants, which is something that I think you get lots of support on. But all of a sudden now we hear about 100-year supply of gas in the United States. In fact, David Brooks had a big column today in the New York Times promoting the use of gas, because I guess gas is a much better fuel than either oil or coal. But I would think that would be a much harder campaign to pitch in the United States than against coal.
So it is a bit of a challenge in the sense that so let me just compare gas to coal. So it is true that gas burns more cleanly than coal, but it is also true that gas is not clean, right? So it's still a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions, albeit less than coal, but still it's a major contributor to climate change. One of the problematic things about natural gas is that the drilling of it, particularly with this technique called hydraulic fracturing, is exempt from almost every relevant piece of federal environmental legislation. So it's not, fracking is not covered by the Clean Air Act, the relevant statutes in the Clean Air Act, or the Clean Water Act, or the National Environmental Policy Act, or the Safe Drinking Water Act, and about a dozen other major pieces of legislation, which is the reason, and the state regulation of natural gas is even more lax. And so that's why what we're seeing right now in Pennsylvania and in other places across the country, that there is a more significant, there's significant risks that gas, that fracking and gas drilling poses on local water supplies and communities, as well as our climate. Last summer, I went to visit some communities in Dimmock, Pennsylvania, northeastern part of Pennsylvania, in the Poconos, or near the Poconos. And, it's just, so I was meeting with families who first you walk past their house, and many of them have wells in their front yard. And this one family, their well blew up. It exploded one day because of the methane releases coming from fracking. The day that I was there, I was reading in the newspaper about how this one guy, his father, was setting up a slip and slide for his kids, like those little things on your lawn. He was setting up for his kids, and there was a spark. And when he turned the water on, there was so much methane in the water that it caught on fire, and the guy had third-degree burns all over his body. I talked with families who can't take showers because they go into the shower and they get sick from all the fumes coming from their shower. They can't drink their water anymore. Their well water is poisoned. So it's tricky because gas is better than coal, burns more cleanly than coal. But if you're a family and if your water is poisoned, it doesn't really matter how it's being poisoned. If your kids are getting sick and you can't take showers, or if your well explodes one day, it doesn't matter if it's coming from coal or from nukes or from gas, it's wrong. And so when I was talking before about the fact that we have to get better at solutions, what I meant to say is that we have to get better at solutions because in the last year, we had this massive mine collapse in West Virginia, coal mine collapse, killed more than 2 dozen workers. We had the Fukushima nuclear meltdown. We had all of these gas problems come up, and there were also concerns about large-scale solar farms being put in the desert and endangered habitat of desert tortoises and other animals. And there's some concerns about large-scale wind farms and the noise that they create. So as an organization, we have to wrestle with these things and find better ways to follow Jim's example and invest in energy efficiency as aggressively as we possibly can. working with homeowners to do that, and then find ways to advance solutions at a large scale that address a lot of these problems. So in short, my short summation of your short question, to which I gave a long answer, is that, yes, it is a hard sell to promote gas as a way to coal, and what we want to do is avoid that and leapfrog over gas as much as we can to promote clean energy. Jim is going to tackle me in a minute if I talk any longer, so I just wanted to say thank you, everybody, for all that you're doing.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on NPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Michael Broon, the executive director of the Sierra Club. He recently spoke at the annual meeting of the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club in Freeport. You can also listen to this program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Michael Broon, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.